Like many parents over this past week, I've been to a school play. And it was fantastic, actually. The kids worked really hard. I know I'm kind of biased, but it was a really, really good play, and I hope that all the parents that went there enjoyed it as much as I did. We, of course, had the traditional elements. We had Mary and Joseph, baby Jesus, shepherds, lots of them, angels, lots of them, and camels and all the rest of it, because there were a lot of kids, and they all had to have parts, of course. We then had the sort of characters that you would imagine were around but don't really read about. So there were people like census takers, one with a particularly bad attitude, Hannah, you know who you are, innkeepers, there was, and of course for the gospel writers we had narrators. So that was all really good. And then finally, and perhaps rather appropriately after Ruth's interview, we had the kind of characters that definitely were made up for dramatic effect. The sort of character that helps tie the whole thing together, if you like. Hi, yeah? And in this particular play, the Nativity, that character was the local midwife. And she even received a call on her first century mobile phone, which was pretty good, actually. The reception was excellent. I was very impressed with that. And the whole story was told in a call the midwife kind of a story, in a kind of way, you know. The midwife got the call that a baby king was on the way, and of course she was desperate to try and find the baby. So along with her talking donkey, another made-up character, she bumped into all the characters on the way, and then when she finally arrived at the birthplace, it was of course a stable, not a palace that she'd been looking for, and the baby was already been born. And as she holds the baby, and I thought this was really rather lovely really, she says, "All this time I've been thinking the baby needed me, but actually I need the baby." And I thought that was really rather lovely. So whoever wrote the play clearly understood something of the meaning of Christmas. I thought it was great. It was thought-provoking. The question is, what was true and what was made up by the playwright? You see, skeptics kind of say it's all a fairy tale. It's all a legend. Mary, Mary, legendary. You can't believe it. It's a made-up story. The early Christians, not perhaps because they needed to write something for the Christmas play, but because, for other reasons, maybe they wanted to give kudos to their religion or whatever. Whatever their reasons were, maybe they were trying to explain the incarnation in a sort of deeply spiritual truths or something like that in ways that didn't actually happen, but they kind of made it up basically. That's the argument. That's the skeptical argument, that it was all made up. It was written at a time later on when perhaps the Christians were a little bit disappointed that Jesus hadn't returned already, and they needed something just to keep things going. It was written down, and by the time it was actually written down in the form that we know it, all sorts of fantastical things and legendary things had been added, and the virgin birth, of course, was just one of those more unbelievable parts of the gospel. And of course, in this scientific age, all this talk surely is nonsense. Can't believe in virgin birth. Surely not. They don't happen. Therefore, there must be another story for another explanation for the nativity. And skeptics maybe take this a little bit further and say, well, look, there were lots of virgin birth stories around at the time, and the Christians just borrowed the story. They just bolted it on to their gospel story and added it in, and it was rather successful, and it seemed to go very well. These legends were normally used to strengthen the position of a particular god, and not uncommonly the ruler, maybe the emperor or Caesar or the pharaoh or whatever. And it just, you know, it just helped with the whole worship me because I'm important kind of vibe. You know, if you say you've got a virgin birth, then, well, you know, that helps. As far as the emperor worship was concerned, it also helped that, you know, worship me at the point of a sword. That was the kind of thing that was going on. But that's the accusation. But humans seem to like telling these stories, and for a whole load of reasons. Maybe some of them I've talked about already. And the early Christians, so skeptic claims, skeptics claim, simply added the birth narratives later to hoodwink a credulous public, giving legitimacy and maybe ultimately even power to their religion. But I'd like to take a few minutes just to put the other side of that story, put the other argument, if you like. You see, I'm one of those that believe what I read in the Bible to be true, a true account. First of all, what about this thing about, well, in a scientific age, you can't possibly believe in virgin births? Well, to that, I think I would say that you don't really need a scientific understanding to know that you don't get virgin births. They kind of knew about the birds and the bees. They were, you know, this was an extraordinary thing. That's the whole point of the gospel stories. This is an exceptional event happening in ordinary times. Something that is noteworthy. Something that is worth writing down. And to say that it's unscientific, I would argue, is an unscientific kind of an argument. it's based not on science, but sort of preconceptions, what you think about already. What I'm saying is that if you start with a belief that God does not exist, you have to find a materialistic answer to everything. And since science studies materials, then you need to have a scientific answer for everything. It needs to be written down. And then it's logical, therefore, to rule out the virgin birth on the same basis that you could rule out ever finding a square circle. It just doesn't exist. It doesn't happen. But this is my point, and this is it, that the conclusion starts with a belief, not a scientific fact. And that belief, or worldview, is that there is no God. If, on the other hand, you consider the idea that there might be a God, well, then the idea of the miraculous becomes possible. Indeed, it can be evidence for your worldview. Maybe not proof, but it certainly does clear the ground for proper historical analysis of the facts. So the question becomes not could it happen, but did it happen? Did it happen? And for that, we really need to turn to the Bible accounts. And in the Bible, the Christmas story is written by two people. Mainly is Matthew, who was a disciple of Jesus, and we've got good evidence that it was actually Matthew that wrote Matthew's Gospel, and Luke, who was an early convert. And again, we've got good evidence that Luke was the one that wrote it. He was an early convert to Christianity. Why did they write their Gospels? Well, they both saw the need to put it on record who this Jesus was. They believed in Jesus, and they wanted others to too. They wanted others to see what the shepherds saw, to see what the wise men saw, to see what Jesus saw, and to understand that. They wanted to make sure that people had access to the facts. Luke explicitly tells us that. If you read the first couple of verses, first three or four verses of Luke's Gospel, he says, I set out from all the accounts that I've got to sift through the evidence and all the accounts and to make an orderly record of what happened so that you might have certainty in what you believe. He writes that to the person that he wrote his Gospel to. And this is important because if it was Matthew, the disciple, and if it was Luke, which I'm sure it was, then when they wrote their Gospels, they would have been in a position to check those facts, to check them out themselves, either being an eyewitness or, in the case of the virgin birth, of course, being able to speak to those that were there, actually sort of interview them and write down the important bits. Of course, they didn't write down everything, but they wrote down the things that pointed out just who Jesus was. So although we can't be exactly certain when they wrote their Gospels, it was probably maybe AD 50, AD 60, that sort of time. So it was really close to the events that they were writing about. And as an aside, of course, Luke was a doctor. So, you know, if anyone, he wouldn't need a few more qualifications to work today as a doctor, but if anyone was going to leave out an alleged virgin birth as being a little bit dodgy and a little bit maybe legendary, and actually I'm interested in the facts, then Luke was the one that was going to do that, if you see what I mean. But we can also be sure that what they wrote is what we've got. And the reason for that is it was the habit of the Christians and the early Christians to meet once a week and to read out the Gospels and the letters of Paul's and all those sort of things and to think about them. And to do that, they needed lots of copies. And so right throughout the ancient world, lots of copies of the Gospels were made. And there are around about 5,000 Greek handwritten copies of the Bible. And then if you include copies in other languages, there's around about 24,000 copies of the Bible that we can refer to. And in addition to that, the early church leaders had a habit of writing letters to each other. And what they did, they used to quote large parts of what we now know as the New Testament, such that if we only had their letters, we could pretty much construct most of the New Testament from what they've written. In other words, there's really good historical evidence to suggest that what we've got as a Bible, and I haven't actually got Bible here, but you've got some around, what we've got is what they wrote. We can be sure of that. And that outstrips any other document by, a factor of 1,000, almost, or certainly 100 or 1,000, of any other document in ancient history. It's that historically sort of sound, if you like. The other reason that I dispute the claim that this is legendary is because how it contrasts with the legends it's supposed to copy. Like the early Christians, I find that it's got that authentic ring. It's about, because when you read Matthew and Luke, it's the extraordinary happening in very ordinary circumstances. Mary is just an ordinary, lowly Jewish girl. Joseph is just a carpenter. Compare that with some of the virgin birth legends at the time, and that's not what you get. Russell was talking about some of the fairy tales. And they've got sort of a formula, a long, long time ago and all the rest of it. Well, a lot of the virgin birth stories have sort of various gods. They probably have mythical animals. And then a lot of goings on that I really don't feel comfortable talking about on a Sunday morning. But the virgin birth story that we read about in the Bible is in complete contrast to that. The other thing is, the virgin birth legends seem to be stories told to increase the status of the child. And I know the virgin birth story does highlight Jesus as special, but actually if you read the rest of the New Testament as well, it's very much going in the opposite direction. It's God becoming man rather than the other way around. And that, by the way, is pretty amazing. And we've got a word for it, incarnation. We call him Emmanuel, God with us. So where are we? Is it legend? Well, my answer is no. No, it's not. Matthew and Luke were real people living at the time of Jesus and in the decades following his death and resurrection. Yes, they were followers of Jesus, but they took time to write a careful account of what happened so that people could be sure that they were putting their faith in something real, something that they could trust. And from the amount of kind of historical evidence, the ancient manuscripts and the letters and all the rest of it, we can be sure that what we have is what they wrote. In other words, we can trust it from that point of view. That's what I'm saying. And the claim, therefore, that the virgin birth story of Jesus was made up later and simply copied from other religious ideas or mystery religions or all the rest of it, just to me doesn't seem to hold up to any kind of scrutiny at all. And finally, of course, this story has legs. It survived while others didn't. No one worships those ancient gods anymore, but people still worship Jesus. The Bible isn't just an ancient manuscript. It's the living word that points to the living Lord Jesus. And that's the thing, really, isn't it? And I saw that a few weeks ago, and I was speaking to Anna. I hope she didn't mind me mentioning this. But when Anna gave her testimony before she was baptized, she'd seen that what she was reading was a real thing compared to pagan spirituality. And I, for one, was certainly moved by her testimony, and I'm grateful to it, and I'm sure many others were as well. And that story can be repeated time and time again. This story is living, it's real, it has relevance today. If then we read that it's a true account, we have to say, well, why does it matter that a teenage girl became pregnant? Maybe just for a few moments now, just to focus on Mary. What it means, that God is, what does it mean? I would suggest a few things, really, that God is intimately involved in his creation. God cares. Mary was a Jewish girl at a time when Israel was suppressed by the Romans. They wanted freedom. They wanted to be saved, if you like. And actually, this story tells us that God was listening to that God was making a way of salvation, maybe not as she imagined, and maybe not just for Israel as well, actually for the whole world. And that is, it sort of blew the mind of anybody that as the early church, they struggled with this concept that actually this wasn't just for Israel, this was for the whole world, this idea of freedom, this idea of salvation. And all the Gospels writers point this out. And when we look at the Nativity in particular, both Matthew and Luke start the New Testament writings by tying them into what happened in the Old Testament. And it's pointed out time and time again in the Gospel accounts that actually this was all part of God's plan. And for Mary, a life of faith wasn't easy. She faced being ostracized, of course. She had to deal with the joys of motherhood, but also the struggles of motherhood. She would have been up in the night feeding her baby in difficult circumstances. And of course we know that she had to flee to Egypt for her own life and the life of her son. She knew what it was like to be a refugee with a young family. A life, it wasn't some idealized sort of kind of faith that we sometimes read about and sometimes see in the carols or the church has sometimes added legend on, perhaps sometimes to Mary. It was a real faith, lived in real circumstances. She was there at his birth, but she was also there at his death. And I'm sure she thought deeply about these things and wondered about these things and struggled with these things at times. Sometimes she got them wrong. Sometimes she did not understand what Jesus was up to. But she still trusted him. We don't know much about Mary, but what we do know is not legendary. It's a real living faith. But of course the story isn't really about Mary. It's about Jesus. The virgin birth really underlines for me the amazing claim that God became man and that he loves us. The fact that Jesus came and was born vulnerable and in humble circumstances, I think is just absolutely amazing. At Christmas time, sometimes, I don't know about you, but if you've got kids, they say, oh, it's lovely, it's so wonderful with the kids. And yeah, I get that, but actually the most wonderful thing about it is that God became a child. And I remember when Ben was really young and holding Ben that first Christmas and thinking, wow, God became like this little child. That's amazing. That's mind blowing. That's wonderful news. It's not just about the children. Actually, it's about one child, and his name is Jesus, Saviour, Emmanuel, Prince of Peace. And that Jesus had an extraordinary birth, lived an extraordinary life, died an exceptional death. But here's the thing: he didn't stay dead. He rose again. And that's what makes Jesus really stand out. And that's why it makes sense for me to say that Mary is an example of faith because of who she put her faith in. It still makes sense now, 2,000 years later. And that's why it makes sense. And that's why at the core of this is the invitation to put our trust in the one who came, became a baby, died, rose again, and lives forever. And actually did that because he loves us and did that because he wants to save us. It's better than any legend I know. Thank you.